It's really lovely to be here back at my alma mater. I spent many years studying here, and well, I did a degree in English and philosophy. I did a bachelor, but I spent many an hour on this level. Actually, I preferred this level. It's changed a little bit, but writing poems, looking out onto the plane trees out there, when I should have been reading Henry James novels or philosophical discourses. And so it's really nice to be back here with the Friends of the Bar Smith. I still haunt this library. I love this library. And I regularly come in here finding obscure poetry books that not everything is on the internet, and especially poetry, actually. And so I'm often in here looking for texts, and I still love coming into this library. It's a special place for me. As was said, yeah, I did actually, I guess, begin writing poetry very early. In fact, I was born in a very poetic place. I was born in 1959 in San Francisco, just down the road from where Allen Ginsberg was writing Howl. So very close to the room he wrote it in, actually. So a little coincidence. And I've always tried to branch poetry out, either through radio, to take it away from just the dusty little collection into the wider world, to reach people through radio, and also through projects like putting poetry on street signs or billboards. So I've always had an interest in sort of extending its reach. Radio National's, I think, still a great network, but we've suffered some heavy cuts, very heavy cuts in the last 3 years, and really we're hanging on by our fingernails at the moment. My program was axed 2 years ago. I now work for the documentary and feature unit, but that was also cut in half last year. So I don't know how I'm still there, actually, but I am. So over the years of running Poetica, nearly 20 years, I used to get a lot of extra copies of poetry books, and I donated a lot to the Bar Smith over that time. So currently I've got something like 2,500 poetry books that came into the program, and they were trying to force me to get rid of them because the new look ABC is to be virtually paperless. We're not allowed to have personal collections of books. Everything has to be electronic. And I said, well, no, sorry, I'm staying with these books. So I've managed to find a little bolt hole, but on the day when they finally do get rid of me, there might be a good opportunity for the Bar Smith to... I'll speak to the librarian about a possible donation of the whole collection. I'm going to focus on Invisible Mending tonight, which is the new book, and particularly on the Malaysian material. Behind me, you can see it's just been playing a video I made. Kathy Brooks and I stayed in this amazing old house, which is a reconstructed wooden house, which is provided as an artist residence. And I wrote poetry there, and Kath did her visual imagery there. This is a little sort of video poem, all shot from inside the house. There's no exterior shots. It's all inside the house looking out. And I'm going to read an essay about staying in this house and writing a group of poems. I was researching a type of poetry called the pantun, which is a traditional Malaysian form. And I'll then read a suite of these pantuns. And then we'll probably finish up with some more Adelaide-based poems. Before I do any of that, though, I'll read a brand new one. Can everyone hear me, by the way? Is that loud enough? Good. Terrific. This one is apropos of the demise of Poetica. I wrote it quite recently. And as I said, we've had to go paperless offices. And we don't even get our, an office anymore. In fact, you get a little space in front of a computer. That's it. But I also happen to inherit the entire history of the ABC radio department, because all the previous people had just left and left me all the files. So in having to move off my floor, I had to get rid of all the history from the last, since the 70s really, including amazing little files that said, you know, young actor, name John Bannon, does child roles, good voice, promising. When I say get rid of them, I didn't get rid of them. I had to sort through them, and I've sent a lot of them to the ABC archives. In fact, 183 boxes of them. But given that we've got an interest in libraries and collections and maintaining the past as well, I thought I'd read this one. Packing up the office after the demise of Poetica. One good asteroid would save all this filing. What need for memory if it rains liquid rock and the planet's a ball of ash? Even without the space drama, I have my doubts. I can feel the Zeit's amnesia, its drowse-inducing gas. Who will ever read us, my sweet Manila? The Sulo bin yawns its yellow mouth, and I'm tempted to feed it the lot. Yet, this feels like book burning. One of the files is an old production marked The Poems of Paul Celan. Black milk of past dawns, graves shoveled in air. I save it for who knows which archive prodding finger. What future I hope, have no hope, will be there. Thank you. Okay, I'd like to go on to read the essay now, actually. So, as I said, Kath and I went to this artist residency in Malaysia at a place called Rimbun Dahan, which is just it's about 50 k's from Kuala Lumpur. But it used to be a little sleepy village. Kuala Lumpur is growing so much now that it's almost meeting it now. It's grown out to meet it. But I'll read the essay, and then I'd like to read the poems that come out of the essay. It's called Pantuns in the Orchard. Oh, are there any Bahasa speakers in the audience? That's good, because I'm going to read some Bahasa and my accent's terrible. Sunset. In the still, intensely humid air, the insect and bird sounds increase. The swallows make their last swoops over the pond, and the bats come out to hunt in the orange sky. The bilals from the three local mosques begin their overlapping songs for Maghrib, the evening prayer. One of the prayer singers has a lovely voice, but the other two rasp away, and we wish their loudspeakers would short circuit. The five daily prayers, starting at dawn, keep the hours for us here in this clockless house. We're living in a two-story kampong house, the Rumah Uda Manap. It's over 100 years old and was moved here piece by piece from the banks of the Perak River and restored. The wooden building has a Belian shingled roof and hand-carved scrollwork between the walls and the high ceilings. Internal and external panels are carved with Chinese motifs of fruit, flowers and birds, and painted with the original lime wash colours of beautiful ochres, blues and greens. The house sits among trees laced with kunjia vines at the back of the Rimbun Dahan estate. Rimbun Dahan means laden bough and is the home of Angela and Hijaz Kasturi. Located about 40 kilometres northwest of Kuala Lumpur, it was once an orchard growing mangoes and durians. It's now a 14-hectare garden, a private house, an art gallery, and several studio spaces and dwellings generously loaned to visiting artists from Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and other parts of the world. I'm staying here with my wife, the artist Kathy Brooks. Kath is gathering materials for artworks based on patterning in Muslim architecture and script, traditional fabric design and natural forms, and objects found around the Rimbun estate and on the village roads. I'm researching the traditional Malaysian poetic form, the pantun, and writing some contemporary pantuns of my own. My source book, lent to me by Angela Kasturi, is a lemon yellow edition of Pantun Malayo, edited by R.J. Wilkinson and R.O. Winstead, and published by Malaya Publishing House in Singapore in 1957. There are many types of pantun. The pantun budak budak for children, the pantun berkase sayang for lovers, and the pantun berkite, the chain pantun, imported into Western literature as the pantum, where the second and fourth lines of the preceding stanza become the first and third of the next. I'm more interested in the pantun tunggal, or single pantun. It has four iambic lines with an A-B-A-B rhyme scheme. The first two lines, called the pembayang, draw their imagery from the outside world, nature, farming and village life. And the last two lines, the maksud, turn inward toward human relationships and psychology. Pembayang means hint or atmosphere, and maksud means point or purpose. The connection between the pairs of lines is sometimes obvious, sometimes not. These pantuns function in a similar way to proverbs, riddles, and epigrams. It's not only the brevity and simplicity of the form that attracts me, but the mental motions it embodies. Outward to observe the natural world, inward to the mind, then out again to perceive the connection between the two. Before leaving Australia, I was told by Malaysian scholar Ramy Che Ross that the pantun is still very much a living popular form in Malaysia, used for intimate private correspondence and more publicly during wedding speeches, by politicians in parliament, in student jousts like a rap battle, and as the basis for pop songs. I decided to test out its currency on the Rimbun Dahan estate. Masna, the gardener's wife, says she knows pantuns but is too shy to recite them to me. So is Siti, the cook from the big house. Anum, the gallery manager, is more forthcoming. She recites from memory this traditional pantun. Kalau ada sumo di ladang, bole hamba menyupang mandi. Kalau ada umo yang panjang, bole kita berjumpa lagi. Her quick translation is, if there's a pond in the field, may I take a bath? If I live long enough, can we meet again? The veiled eroticism of bathing in this person's pond is the pembayang, with its natural external imagery. Then the deepened meaning, the personal psychological one, which the maksud makes clear, means this pantun is, in effect, a proposal of love. They're naughty but nice, this species of pantun. You can ask if you have a future together by saying, can I have a dip in your paddock? Very useful in the modest and highly circumscribed Muslim Malay culture. Anam also tells me that she found several pantuns when looking through a box of old love letters written by her parents in their courting days. A standard finish to the letters was Pekka kaka pekka galas suda baka harap balas. Break mirror, break glass, after reading, hope reply. This sort of pantun is used in a formal way. The first two lines employed to achieve the rhyme are not always consequential. Another example mentioned by Winstead in Pantun Malayo is where a moral message is carried simply by mentioning four kinds of fish. Siakap senahong gulama ikan diri. Because this rhymes with birchakap pun bohong lama lama menchuri, which means if you start by lying, you'll end by stealing. But this second half is often left unsaid. An English equivalent might be something like sticks and stones will break my bones, where the message of the completing rhythmic line is so well known we don't need to voice it. Some pantuns are rather heavily loaded with proverbial wisdom, but others have a lighter touch and a joy in natural atmosphere. In this aspect, they are similar to haiku. They can also be delightfully erotic. Henri Fauconnier, a rubber planter turned writer, gives this pantun in his 1930 novel Malaisie. Karenga di dalam bulo, serahai barisi ayamawa, sampai hasrat di dalam tubo, Tuan sa orang jadi penawa. Red ants in the hollow of a bamboo, vessel filled with essence of roses. When lust is in my body, only my love can bring me appeasement. No one knows the exact age of the Pantun form. Raimi Che Ross told me that evidence from engravings on tombs suggests it goes back to at least the 13th century. Its earliest appearance in manuscript in the Saraja Malayu dates from the beginning of the 17th century. The Pantun first appeared in English through the writings of the British colonialist Sir Stamford Raffles and William Marston's Grammar and Dictionary of the Malay Language, published in 1812. The Pantun Berkait was later imported into French via a letter from the children's author Ernest Fournier to Victor Hugo, which contained an example called Pantun Malay. Hugo published it in 1829 in his book Les Orientales, Odes and Ballads. Charles Baudelaire further popularised the Pantun, publishing his own Harmonie du Soir in 1857. 20th century and contemporary poets such as Donald Justice, John Ashbery, Carolyn Kaiser, and our own John Anderson, Lauren Ford, and Geordie Elbiston have used the linked Pantun in their work. But back to the Pantun Tunggal, the single Pantun. My aim is to write one per day, four good concentrated lines. In this task, I often fail. Some days, nothing comes. On others, I write three Pantuns to discover the next day that not one of them is worth keeping. They're small poems, but risky. Because they have a rhyme scheme and a beat, which I admit I only follow loosely, but especially because the Maxud insists you say something compact about the human condition, you always walk on the edge of the trite, the too neat summation. In setting a daily target, I work with what comes to hand in the house and around the Rimbourne estate, the pond, and the way microcosms of water gather in the bowls of the lotus leaves after a rainstorm. A dizzy gecko landing next to my writing table a few moments after I turn on the overhead fan. A bobbing dove snapping the branch on which it stands with its mate. The roadside fires the locals light every sunset. But then other larger events overtake me. Halfway through the residency, my father dies suddenly. He'd been suffering from dementia, but was physically well. And my biggest fear was that after 3 months away, he wouldn't recognise me when I returned. I never expected that I wouldn't see him alive again. We fly back to Adelaide and midwinter grief, cold rain, the funeral, some time with my mother in the family home, then resume our trip. Coming back to this carved wooden house in a tropical garden feels like a false reality. Writing little four-line poems, vain and irrelevant. I have constant dreams just before dawn each day in which my father appears to me and wakes me by calling my name. Eventually, when I can write again, the opening pantun of the sequence grows from this. The light comes so slowly, another hazy, smoky dawn. Dreams of my dead father woke me early. There's too much time, then there's none. The sun is now well down behind the plong trees. Kath and I put our work aside and go out for an evening stroll. Down the road, our friend, the sculptor Dan Walmering, is sitting at a desk outside his cottage. He's stripped to the waist, quietly working on little cardboard shapes he is sticking together with masking tape. Spread out on the desk is his collection of seed pods and leaves from the local trees that have helped inspire some of the maquettes he's so carefully crafting. Next, we call on another of our new artist friends, Samsudin Wahab, who's just starting for the day. He's a young Malaysian painter who does manga-style oils and liner cuts featuring grinning, skull-like self-portraits that are highly satirical and political. Samsudin works all through the night while playing Red Hot Chili Peppers on his headphones and chain-smoking. He targets media, corrupt judges and police. So I show him a pantun on the subject. As well as the Book of Hours, I've been working on a group of modernisations from the old Pantun Malayo, altering either the Pembayangs or the Maksuts so they refer to more contemporary life. The judge faces the camera and lies. He's bent what's right. The law is a black fowl that flies by night. It's based on the Ayam Hitam Terbang Malam Pantun, where a black rooster flying at night is used to mean something inscrutable and clandestine. Samsudin shows us some new ink drawings in which he's morphing humans into objects that symbolise them. A policeman's head becomes a gun. A fat politician fuses with his limousine. Samsudin asks for further suggestions. What about a mufti transforming into the bulging dome of his mosque, I say. But that's off limits in today's Malaysia, even for Samsudin. His art looks wild, but he's still a good Muslim, doesn't drink, and his girlfriend wears the tudung headscarf. Earlier in the week, I had an opportunity to read some of the pantoms to an audience of young Malaysian architecture students when they came to visit the Rimbun Estate and Art Gallery. Standing in front of ominous bitumen paintings by Jalani Abu Hassan, depicting cleared hillsides and burnt out forests, I tried out a handful of pantuns. The erotic and the environmental ones seemed to get the strongest reaction. Oil palms, oil palms, oil palms, oil palms. Freeways, 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 freeways. Oil palms, oil palms, oil palms, oil palms. Smoke haze, smoke haze, smoke haze, smoke haze. I realise that it's months since we've seen the stars here. It's not only the localised burning of rubbish, there's a permanent haze in the sky and the smell of smoke. We're told it's the Indonesians burning the forests of Sumatra. But of course, much of the smoke comes from the clearing of land here for the advancing ocean of oil palms. I think because of all the reports about Malaysia cutting down its own forests and the forests of others, I expected it to be a wasteland with no place for fauna left. But where we live is rich in wildlife. Obviously, being in a 14-hectare garden helps. But even wandering around the back roads, we see many monkeys in the trees. The estate is home to wrens, pied robins, peaceful doves, kingfishers, squirrels, grey and long-tailed macaques. And there are also monitor lizards called biwa in the ponds. These look scary. They're much bigger than a goanna and swim very fast. But they're harmless, so we're told. A little bat often flies into the dining room at night while we're eating, and our walls are home to pale, clucking geckos. We also have a visitor we never see, except for its droppings downstairs. The workers here tell us it's a musang, a civet. Coming back to the house after our walk, the sounds of the night flood in through the open shutters. We want to live in nature, but above it. And yet, in the end, we can't escape being part of it. With the lights off, it's possible to wonder if we're inside or outside the house. The pantuns shift back and forth between nature and culture, little worlds built in the face of transience. I write about 30 in my time at Rimbun Dahan and decide to assemble some of them into this Book of Hours, which starts at dawn and finishes under the mosquito net in the warm, clicking night. Thank you very much. And now I'll move on to those 30 panton, which, as I say, start at dawn and go through to night. So it's a book of hours. They're designed to be separate little poems, but they do have a kind of sequence. The light comes so slowly. Another hazy, smoky dawn. Dreams of my dead father woke me early. There's too much time. Then there's none. I start the great four-bladed ceiling fan. Seconds later, a gecko drops to the floor, stunned. Yes, the world's like that. We all hang on as long as we can. In the house of shutters but no window glass, the outside world slips across dark wood mirrors. Shum hammering in the heat, Siti sweeping the path, life in slivers. Landing next to her, the little male dove bobs so vehemently on the twig it snaps. His need to impress his love means now they both must flap. Last night, a gecko ate a grasshopper's body and left its head, still alive this morning, on the floor. Time eats you like that, but more slowly. You become a twitching mask of thoughts. Mosquitoes fly out when you shift something black, whining and hiding again in the room. Some people I know like to hurry back to restore themselves in comfortable gloom. That cicada sounds like a dentist, drilling all day into my eye-tooth nerve, shrilling on and on about time, everything you love but can't preserve. The swallows loop back over the pond, dive and circle as they must do. Words repeat in my mind, words I failed to say when I most needed to. Gathering thunder. The eye of the day winks smoky orange, slips under a tuduk of purple and monsoon grey. Add to this drama the bilal and rooster. Out of the sky of luminous black, rain falls joyfully. You and I, who lived so long alone together, now walk again under one umbrella. The lotus leaves hold silver discs, small worlds of water above the pond. Why did I think my circle so small and nothing beyond? The wren in the dripping congea vine flutters off water from the storm. Our ceiling leaked, on the floor puddles shine, resilient in the afterlight, the quiet forms. The sour smoke of roadside fires, rubbish smoulders at end of day, old needs, hopes half realised, and something else we threw away. The pattern of the stone path disappears under a new green ikat of moss. Walking it gives me a change of mood. Why all this thinking about loss? Under the mosquito net, settling to sleep, you feel safe from the world's attacks. Then you hear the needling, invisible whine of that one mosquito inside the net, the mind. From the estate's wall, grey macaques leap into the laden mango tree. From your side of the bed, you told me to sleep, but the night's so warm and I want something juicy. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'll finish off with three poems. This book is a mixed genre book. It's a collection of essays, prose works, and poetry, and photos by Kath. So I'd just like to bring it back to Adelaide. I'm sure you all know what a quincunx is, the pattern of our five squares, the dice pattern, the five pattern, just in case you think I'm being rude. Adelaide, you old quincunx. Colonel Light playing tic-tac-toe on the Garner's pages. That little brown snake of a river winding through its parkland's frame. Over your eastern stairs, the sun appears, filtering through skylights, the footfall echo of your arcades, to end with a long bath in the west. Your curve of beaches, which are summer's collective. Clever, pretty, but lacking confidence, exposed here on your plane. We always have to talk you up, get your festival clothes on. I like you best in November, when you spill buckets of jacaranda. April too, when the slow light cools into shouts in the stadia. Even now, after a week of 40 degrees, it's raining at last. Upstairs at the Exeter, I can hear chuckles in the gutters, and applause from the rooftops. Beyond the brown haze of your suburbs, we smell desert, so we love to see the water run. Adelaide, Heimat of sandstone terraces, gargoyles, lacunae, suffocations. Once I thought you were too small, but after all these years we fit each other. Here in front of Benython Hall, my first memory, A pantomime giant came down through the floodlit trees, chasing Jack and his golden harp. Place is voice as much as view. Legs like Paynham Road, a pash at Windy Point. It's better up there than Los Angeles. That hot glitter all the way to the Gulf. And thank you. And the last time I saw Don Dunstan alive, he was running his restaurant in the parade. I don't know if you ever went there, Don's Table, do you remember? Yes. And he was just talking to his customers, really, and he was serving the bread. And I thought, it's amazing. What an amazing thing, such a visionary leader, a great leader in our state's history, to be serving bread to his customers at the end of his life. I thought it's sort of almost like a biblically humble kind of image. But it stayed in my mind, and I was walking past the site of his old restaurant one night, and I had this vision of Don meeting the ghost of Don Dunstan on Norwood Parade. He slipped out of the median strip trees, carrying a humble bread roll on a white china plate. "Here," he said, "a gift from the shades. You're still dining out at my table." Heads turned at the sidewalk cafes, all the fine-looking women of Norwood sensing a presence, but still unfazed. "You've all gone back to sleep," Don said. "I wanted a renaissance, not a dormitory with malls." "I liked Pliny, Parsi, eggs and young men, and I made a few mistakes. No one's perfect. It's necessary to break open some tombs if you intend to raise a dead state." Then parrots shrieked past, flying over the red galvo roof of the grandstand. Still holding his serving tongs, the ghost began to fade, disappearing into the listless night of shop signs and car lights blinking along the parade. Okay, I'll just finish with this one called Back Again, which has a double meaning in back again, like going backwards, but also returning, coming back. I wrote it after a holiday, travels in Europe over the summer, and then coming back to midwinter in Adelaide, which is always a, you know, just the light hits you straight away when you see Adelaide. And again, something about the sky hits you when you've been in Europe. But also, unfortunately, the very first thing I heard when I turned on the car radio was Minister Dutton. So there's another sense of back again here. Went out a door in Prague summer. Came into this wintry house in Adelaide. Hibernation time again on the forgetting side of the world. Temporary, horizontal, raw. Suburbs that seem to say, "Don't get any grand ideas, you and this sea of sheds." Now we lie close in the middle of the bed, remembering the warmth our children came from. Awake before dawn, I listen to your lagged breathing. Imagine how cruel it would be here without you. Would this house be a burial cave, or would I dig myself out again? The moonlight, even in winter, is clearer and brighter here, and there are birds instead of bells. Our magpie, we call it ours, tries its run of notes, falters, repeats, like our writing and art careers. I regret switching on the radio. A voice from the regime boasts its perfect score, turning away the desperate. We will lose our public service jobs, retreat to our gardens, drink alcohol around the fire, protest, write blogs, and wait for the unauthorised return. Summer shining there under the door. Thank you very much.